Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things. On community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. We get together here once a week here at the KHOI studios in beautiful downtown Ames. We talk about food. We talk about farming, recipes, advice, opinions. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Yes, support comes from Wheatsville Co-op, your full-service natural grocer in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsville Co-op.
Yes, we do. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is KHOI Community Radio. Welcome to our kitchen table. This is a time of harvest, of holidays, of gatherings. Ooh, I do love gravy. Yes, I do. I hope you had a good Thanksgiving last week.
And I hope you saved the carcass and you're making stock.
Mm-hmm. Good advice
from
Donna.
Waste not, want not.
Good advice from Donna. Oh, yes. Turkeys give and give and give. Yes, they do. So we've had harvest, we've had holidays, and
More holidays to come.
More holidays
here
to
we
come.
Go. Here we go.
We celebrate a full larder. We celebrate food. And it all comes back to the farmers. We celebrate the harvest now because someone has planned, planted, tended, herded, and cared for all the parts of our food system that bring all those good things to our table. Today, we meet a young farmer. He raises cows, he milks them, and I heard someone say once, blessed are the cheesemakers.
Amen.
Well, yes, they are blessed. Today in our studio, we have
Kevin Dietzel.
Kevin Dietzel, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Good.
Kevin is a young, new farmer with a lovely wife and two children, right?
Two children. Three and five.
And he, unlike corn farmers who are kind of finishing their work for the season, dairy farmers work all the time, don't they, Kevin?
Yes. Well, some will be seasonal and they'll dry the cows off in the winter. The timing of the lactation of our cows hasn't worked out that way, and we are planning to milk year-round to also be able to be making cheese year-round and have a continual supply.
Good.
So Kevin has Lost Lake Farm.
Tell us about Lost Lake Farm.
First of all, where is it?
Well, Lost
it's Lake really
Farm.
It's really nearby?
Yeah, it is. It's just north of Jewell, so we're maybe 30 miles north of Ames.
So Kevin is truly our local cheesemaker.
That's right. So the reason that our farm is called Lost Lake Farm is because we are at the north end and on the north shores of what used to be Lake Cairo.
Really? What happened to it?
It was a 1,500-acre shallow lake. Some people called it Mud Lake, depending what record you looked at, because it was, you know,
was it like
anywhere
a large
from,
prairie pothole, basically?
Well, yeah, kind of. It was maybe 8 feet at the deepest, but
it was a natural geological formation.
It was a natural geological formation. It was, but it was 1,500 acres. That's pretty big.
Oh my!
And they, in the 1890s, all the landowners in that area decided they wanted farmland there, and they drained it, and they did a humongous project, and there are some of the biggest drainage ditches I've ever seen that were dug from 1895 to 1898 or something like that.
Right, and it's right on your farm.
It's on the eastern border of our farm is one of the big drainage ditches. And if you are driving on Highway 69 north of Jewell, you can see the main drainage ditch of all of Lake Cairo that goes by the side of Highway 69 there, just right next to the golf course. It is humongous, and it feeds into the Skunk River.
And what kind of soil does that leave you guys with?
That leaves us with a little piece of Minnesota. It's called our soil type on the lake bottom. Not all of our farm is actual lake bottom. We have some upland soils too, but we have what is called blue earth mucky silt loam.
Blue Earth Mucky Salt Loam. That sounds like a poem, kind of, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
Or
it is so named
flavor.
Because the first of that type was found in Blue Earth, Minnesota. And it's not a true muck soil, but it is a very high organic matter soil, very deep.
So this is good, right?
That is very good. I dug some post holes at the corners of the farm when I was first fencing it when we moved there 5 years ago.
Right. You got to build fences. And, you got cows.
And I dug 3.5 feet deep, and I was in a horizon topsoil the whole 3.5 feet. Now, when you get up towards the beach, towards our tree line, because then it's shallower. There's actually sand on the top. You can see sandy beaches in some places. So the grass doesn't grow great there. But we also have some 150-year-old bur oaks in a kind of a steep shoreline that are a remnant of, they were never cut down because it didn't work very well for cropland because it's sloping in Hamilton County.
And how many acres do you have?
Roughly 80. And so we rent that from my uncle and aunt who purchased it in order to rent it to us.
And I believe it's called Dietzel's Folly?
Dietzel's Folly.
Yes.
Oh.
That's what his uncle calls it.
Yes. He has spent some time in England, and he got some of the English sense of humor from there and put that onto there.
But that's very good of him to support his nephew, the young farmer.
Yes, it is.
Because land acquisition is the hardest part of beginning farming, right, Kevin?
Yeah, it took us quite a few years to find the right arrangement and then find the right land. It wasn't like I had this favorite uncle who was like, hey, I hear you like farming. Why don't I buy a farm for you? No, it was probably a 10-year process of, thinking, oh, well, we'll just, buy an acreage and then build from there, and then realizing, well, if I want to do dairy, there's no way that'll ever get me anywhere. And then seeing different opportunities and trying to look into them and just seeing, I turned down other opportunities. And the reason that you have to find the right setup, because I've seen a lot of people who dreamed for years about being farmers and then got themselves into the first land opportunity they could and with working with a landowner or some organization or whatever that mm-hmm. really wanted them to do this land. But if it's not the right setup, the social things can kill it. It can kill your dreams.
That's true of any small business, isn't it?
You have to pick your partners carefully. Yeah, it has to be the right setup for that to work. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm.
And then you own the dairy building and the home?
Yeah, so we own the 5 acres, the acreage where our home is and where all the buildings are and where we put up a new building, which is where we milk the cows and make the cheese.
Great. So, Kevin, why cows? Farmers can farm a lot of things. Why for you? Why did cows end up in your?
Further, life? Why cheese from the cows?
Yeah, why? Yeah, tell me about your cheese journey.
Well, first I'll answer the cows question. I fell in love with cows probably when I was 7 or 8 years old.
Oh, me too. I'm very envious of you. I always say I've been a milkmaid many lifetimes. It's just yes. Oh, Kevin.
So what kind of cows do we have? We have various breeds. We started out, the first heifer calves we bought were Brown Swiss from the Gilbert family, Gibraltar Farms. They're near Iowa Falls.
Uh-huh.
So we bought some heifer calves from them and bottle fed them. We still have those two. One of our cheeses is named after one of them. It's called Ingrid's Pride, and Ingrid was one of our first two cows. We have been crossing to Normandy, which is a French breed.
And what color are they?
They are red and white. So and a lot
like
of them
spotted,
have
like a deeper
brindled.
Brindled. Ooh, pretty. And what are they smaller like the Swiss?
They're smaller than a Swiss.
Oh.
Swiss are about as big as they come. Some people call them elephants of the dairy world.
They're bigger than Holstein?
They can be often. Holsteins and Swiss will rival each other size-wise. Now, the original actual Swiss brown fee are smaller, but the American brown Swiss is a big breed.
We blew them up, yeah.
Yeah, and they produce more, too.
Yeah.
So, and why are we bringing in the Normandy? What's the appeal of that for you?
Well, they're pretty, and they do...
Yes!
They do really well on a rough diet, on pasture. So, because we...
You're grass feeding, right?
Right. We do give them a little bit of grain in the parlor, essentially as a treat to lure them in.
So they want it, yeah. So they cooperate.
Yeah. But other than that, we're... I mean... So we're 99% grass-fed, and so genetics are important in that, but also the way you raise them and so forth. But they also have really good quality milk. They have high butter fat, high protein, you know, not as high as a Jersey, but they will rival Brown Swiss.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other portions of the type of capercaseine, which is important for cheese making.
And are they, what's that called, the new typing that they're putting into milk?
Is the A2?
A2?
They
red.
Have a high frequency of A2.
Uh-huh.
And what, pray tell, is an A2?
It is.
A2 Brute? No, that's not.
No, it's A, like capital A, okay. The beginning letter of the alphabet.
So okay. A2, A2. So there's A2, A1, A2. So it's a genotype. That's why it has the weird thing. It has to do with the type of protein.
And supposedly the A2 milk is less allergenic, right?
That's my understanding.
That's how they're pushing it these days.
Yes. But there's another, and I'm blanking on what it's called right now, but it's another genotype that has to do with the capercaseine, which is not health related, but more cheese yield and cheese quality related.
Oh,
and
yes.
They also have a higher gene frequency of that genotype. In the Normandy breed. A neat thing about Normandy breed, they are the breed, if you've ever had the Camembert cheese, that's from the same region.
Yes.
And
okay.
So that's from Normandy cows.
Now I see where you're going with this, Kevin. I've had some of Kevin's soft rind cheeses.
Oh, that's what that is. How many cows does one need, or how many do you have?
What can you
make
put on
herd?
80 acres?
How many?
So we have right now 11 of our own cows that we're milking. We have 4 of somebody else's that are on a lease arrangement.
So they live at your house?
They live at our place.
So they're all getting the same pasture and the same management, basically.
Yeah, so essentially it's somebody else who's trying to start a herd and doesn't have a farm yet, and so wanted to buy some cows, and
okay,
it's also helping us.
Does that still qualify you as a closed herd for your cheese making?
Yes, because they're all on site.
Okay. Because in the cheesemaker's world, having a, quote, closed herd means you are growing your own milk and you have a lot more control over the quality of the milk, the sanitation of the milk. It's a big plus in the cheesemaking world.
Right.
Premium product.
Yeah. The only difference, we do not have ownership of these cows.
Yeah,
and
okay,
so
they're in your herd.
They're in our herd. We have a year contract. They've been here for 3 months.
Okay,
they
so
will
you
be
have
here through...
You're milking 15?
We're milking 15.
Now, that seems small. Being from Wisconsin, that's a small herd. But that probably means that these cows get a lot of attention. And you milk, what, twice a day?
Yes. I don't do all the milking myself. Mm-hmm, I do have 2 part-time employees.
Mm-hmm.
And
what kind of parlor do you have?
It's a pit parlor. We took some of all the dimensions and so forth from an Iowa State Extension design called the Trans-Iowa Parlor, which is essentially a low-cost parlor design. So it's a pit. I stand down, you know, maybe 3 feet below the cows, and they're on a platform elevated.
And you do 2 at a time?
We milk 4 at a time.
4 at a time.
Is this just
like
on
the one that
side.
Francis Tickey has?
It would be, but a lot smaller.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it's very civilized that we call the place to milk cows a parlor. It sounds so nice. A nice gathering place. So
For the ladies.
For the yes. And so what is it like 12 hours apart? When do cows, like I've heard the term letting down their milk. When are they ready to milk?
Well, so it is roughly 12 hours apart. Uh-huh. It's a little bit, the way we schedule it, it's a little bit longer from the evening to the morning. So
they can sleep.
So we do.
So you can sleep.
Well, yeah, and it's all, and so that we aren't, you know, working till 9 p.m., you know, so we milk at 5:30 in the morning and 4:30 in the afternoon.
Oh.
So how
do the girls like daylight savings time?
You know, they adjust pretty well.
Oh, it,
you know, and we say 4:30 and 5:30, and we actually, we push that around. Well, my employees don't push it around very much. They show up on time and they milk on time. But when I do the milkings, it's not always on time. So that's
your prerogative. Very good.
Well, we forget that Kevin, in addition to milking the cows, he has to make the cheese. That's a whole other business, right?
It is. That's a more than full-time job right there. Is just
okay,
making
so
the cheese.
Okay, so tell me what a cheese-making day looks like.
Well, my alarm goes off at 3:30 a.m. I go out, and the first thing I have to do is I have to test the milk for antibiotic residue. This is a requirement
by
the state.
The milk in the vat, right?
It's still in the bulk tank. Before I ever transfer it. So the bulk tank is where the milk is stored between milkings and cooled.
Mm-hmm.
So before I ever transfer it, so I know and can document to the state that there's no antibiotic residue, even though I know I haven't given them any antibiotics, I still have to document that there's no residue.
Got the rules to follow.
So I have to do that, and that takes about an hour. Then
really?
I pump the milk over into the pasteurizer.
Give me an idea of how many gallons we're talking about here on a typical day.
Right now it's 60 to 70 gallons every other day.
Okay.
So I pump it over and immediately start heating it up. And the vat, which is also the pasteurizer, I do it all in the same vat.
So what method are you using? Low?
It's a low temperature vat pasteurization. And so this is a jacketed vat. It has hot water in the vat, mm-hmm. so that it's not just getting heated from
right,
the bottom.
Right, you don't want to burn you don't want that burned
right, and you
smell.
Want even all around mm-hmm. the sides and the bottom. And so I heat it up to 145 degrees. The milk has to be 145 degrees, and then you pump your putting steam into the top, the air temperature in the top of the vat has to be 150 degrees. And when those two conditions are met, then you hold it there for 30 minutes.
Is there an agitator in the tank?
There's an agitator in the tank that
so
is stirring it.
So the whole thing is that temperature.
That whole time. And mm-hmm. so it is documenting the air temperature and product temperature as you're doing this. And that's, you know, and I have to keep all these records from mm-hmm. every batch and have it tied to, if you, you know, see our cheese packaging, it says made on that date. And that can be tied back to my, you know, the pasteurization records and the antibiotic test records and everything, you know. So if there's a problem or anything like that, I can go back and I have all the records of everything.
Okay, so you're pasteurizing, but you're not homogenizing.
I am not homogenizing.
Okay.
And I'm not doing any separating or anything. It's just
so
whole
it's
milk
whole,
as
the
is.
The whole thing that – okay.
Okay,
so then you get your pasteurization done and you've got warm milk. Then what happens?
Then I cool it down again.
Oof.
Yeah, so I do that by running cold water through the jacket
steam
of the
jacket.
Vat.
Okay.
Yeah. So I, and that so it takes maybe an hour to heat it up to the pasteurization temperature, half an hour of pasteurizing, and then maybe 45 minutes to cool it back down.
Are
again.
You out there milking the cows while this is going on?
No, it's too much jumping around, and I don't want to wear. I want to be really careful about cleanliness, so I don't wear farm clothes into the processing area.
Okay, so, yeah,
area.
You're not going out into the barn and back into
well, of
the
course.
Cheeser.
Cheese clothes, chore clothes. I could see the difference, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and I have done it. I have milked and done that, but it is crazy, and it's really hard. It takes a lot of focus because you have to be there right at specific
yeah,
times.
Like, now, where was
things.
I? What am I? What time is
and
it?
And if I'm thinking about what cow is getting milked and also, like, what – you know, what's my next cheese step? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that I can do to fill the time. You know, there is maintaining cheeses in the aging room because I have to brush them regularly. And there's a lot of cleaning. I spend probably most of my cheese-making time actually washing dishes, cleaning floors, cleaning walls.
It's amazing,
you name
isn't it.
It?
Yep.
For you. So after you've heated... Cooled. Or then you turn it in. Then you end up with pasteurized milk. And the next step is
adding culture. So I purchase a freeze dried culture, bacterial culture. It's kind of similar to like the yeast packets that you get. So it looks like a powder, but you have to keep it cool when you're storing it.
So that way you have control over what bacterial input is going in there, right?
Right. And so, you haven't completely killed everything with the pasteurization, but essentially what you're putting in the culture is what is there.
That'll
for
be the
your,
dominant bacterial.
Yeah, and it's growth. A mix of several different ones.
Okay.
So I measure how much I have for that day, and, you know, how much milk is in the vat that day, and then I weigh out my culture and, you know, do my calculations and add it on top, stir it in, and then I let it sit for 1 to 2 hours, depending on the cheese.
So
and it's coming alive.
You're kind of like mozzarella?
Well, mozzarella or provolone are kind of the two things.
And it comes alive.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, kind of like the yeast, you're adding it to the water, and then it's like saying, perking up. It's saying, ooh, this is a good temperature. Oh, there's some moisture. Ooh, look, there's a food source, too. Mm-hmm. This is really good. And it starts to come alive, and then, as it comes alive, then it starts to replicate, and it starts to ferment and so forth. And, so then after it has started to come alive and start to ferment a little bit.
And how do you know when it's happy? And I mean, like with bread, it rises. What happens? How do you tell with milk?
pH.
Oh. Little test strip?
I have a pH meter because I take a lot of measurements, and pH strips are a very...
Well, they're
rough measurements.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so you got a pH meter.
Yeah, and the other thing is that later on when you're measuring the pH in the curd, you can really only take the measurement of the whey pH with the strips. And so I can squeeze the whey out and take a measurement of the curd pH with my pH meter, and that'll be very different than the whey pH. And the curd pH is what you need to monitor. Generally.
We're talking cheese. We're talking cheese with Kevin Dietzel. This is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are celebrating a local cheesemaker today. Kevin Dietzel's in the room.
Yeah, we're being real cheesy today.
Yeah, Kevin Dietzel is with us today. And you've been listening to, it's a Bill Monroe bluegrass tune. It's called the Bluegrass Stomp. A little connection here. Bluegrass, cows like grass. And we're glad that cows eat the grass. And a person like Kevin can turn it into delicious, delicious cheese.
Yeah, so Kevin has a farm called Lost Lake Farm. He's making... This is our own local cheesemaker, although I'm sure it'll eventually travel all over the state. And it's going to be available in both Hy-Vees, Kevin, and Wheatsfield.
It is now in both Hy-Vees and...
Yip-de-doo.
Hopefully by the time this airs, it will be in Wheatsfield as well.
Right, because, they're gonna have their new cheese station. So I think Connie's going to make a place for you in there, we hope. So... we're talking about the cheese making process, so we're going to taste some. Lucky Lana and I. What have we got here, Kevin?
Well, I forgot to bring my fresh mozzarella, and I was going to bring all of our cheese types. I guess you only get to try some of them. So I have mozzarella cheese curds, and I got the plain ones out because those are my favorite of all of the cheese curds we make, which we have several varieties that we add different herbs
and so forth. They're just flavors.
They're
that
just
you
flavors
add, right?
That we add, you know, they're surface added. I like this because I like to taste the actual cheese. Like the benefit of having grass-fed milk and mm-hmm. having your own cows is that you can control that taste and, you know, and
I have to say, I agree with Kevin. And like for me, it sends me right back to my childhood, because my dad was in the dairy business, and he would take us into the factory. It was a slightly larger company, and magically he'd open the big vat and he'd take out the curds, and we called it squeaky cheese.
Yeah, so these were made on Saturday.
Oh, they're wonderful.
So they still have a little bit of squeak in them. The mm-hmm. squeak only lasts a little while because as the proteins are broken down by the cultures and so forth, the structure changes and it loses the squeakiness. Mm-hmm. The squeakiness has to do with the freshness.
Tell me about cheese curds. They are kind of like the very first, usually the first thing that happens. They happen quickly in the process, or first in the process.
Yeah, well, so I'd have to kind of go back to our process.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To explain how we get to that. So where we left off, I had added culture, let it sit for an hour, mm-hmm. and then I add rennet.
Rennet.
Which is an enzyme, which...
Does it really come from the cow's stomach anymore, or is it...
It does.
It still does.
What I use...
A real rennet.
You can get what is called vegetarian rennet, but it is actually... What is usually called vegetarian rennet is actually bacterial rennet. Mm. So it's a GMO product that is created... It is identical to what comes from the calf's stomach, but it is created by bacteria.
But you're using the real thing.
I'm using the real thing because, I don't know, I feel like it's more genuine and...
Well, plus you have a biodynamic organic operation going on there.
Yeah, there you go. I can see arguments for not taking it from a calf's stomach and so forth. Because it has to be a calf, because it's the enzyme that calves use to break down the milk for their own nutrition.
Oh, really?
So does this come from basically harvesting veal? Is that where it's coming from?
Probably. Yeah. I assume so.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do that. I mean,
something has to take the liquid and turn it into something that's more solid. The rennet does
that's
that.
That's what the rennet does. So the rennet is...
So it's a coagulant, basically?
It's a coagulant. That's exactly what it is. I don't want to get too much into the chemistry of it, but it's essentially cleaving the bond between the water and the protein because those proteins and fats, they don't want to stay in a liquid form. And they're in this complex matrix chemically when they're in milk. And it's cleaving those bonds, and then they clump together.
Cleaving means cutting them. Right. Breaking.
Well, enzymatically cutting them.
Uh-huh.
And that takes about an hour for that to turn into almost like jello. This when it's
so then you
like
kind
pudding.
Of have blobs floating in.
No, it's a one solid mass.
Ah,
and then I cut the curd into like 3/8 inch cubes. Mm-hmm. So I have.
It's kind of a fun process to.
It is fun. I have what I call curd knives or curd harps.
Mm-hmm.
Which
curd
are
curd harps.
Well, because they look like harps. They're
wow, yeah,
they're about
they're
2 feet wide and about 4 feet high, 4 feet long,
mm-hmm.
and they have wires. If one is vertical and one is horizontal, so I do the vertical one first and then the horizontal one
so
in order to cut it.
This is something you just sort of sink
cubes.
Into the milk tank and draw it.
Yeah, through. I kind of put it down in there
like
and
cutting
drag
with the cheese
it kind
wire,
of in a,
really?
In, a
yeah.
In a grid pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And you're cutting first columns with the vertical one and then you cut those columns mm-hmm. into cubes.
Well, slice and dice.
The resulting curds are lovely. It's fresh. You can really taste. You can taste the milk. Well, you can taste the cow. But you have plain cheese curds, plain, which are lovely. But then you have branched out and you put other tastes with things. When do you put the other flavorings with your cheese curds?
Well, it's actually so the cheese curds that you see here, they're not. Mm-hmm. This is not what's cut with the cheese with the curd knife.
Okay.
With the curd knife, I'm cutting it, and that is letting that's increasing the surface area of the curd, and then it pushes the water pushes the whey out.
Then
it all settles to the bottom.
The curds
and then
go to
I
the
let,
bottom, and you've got...
And then I let the whey drain out,
okay,
and I
so
just collect it in buckets.
Okay, so whey is essentially the water. And
it's water and all the water-soluble components, which are mostly the sugars, which is lactose.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some water-soluble proteins. And so that all goes out. And the fresh whey smells so fantastic.
Well, and it has some good nutrition, right?
Yeah,
there's
it's really good for you.
A lot of new athletic protein drinks are made with dried whey these days. So what are you doing with your whey?
Well, I did have some pigs that I was feeding it to. But then when that group was done and got turned into bacon and ham and... to eliminate one thing for now, we'll get more pigs again in the future, but one of my employees who helps part-time on the farm is a beginning farmer himself.
Tom Wilson.
And he has pigs, and so he is
and
taking
farm is
the
called,
way to his farm.
Called?
Remnant Hills Farm.
Remnant Hills. So he will have whey-fed pigs now.
Yes.
So this is one of those things where young farmers are cooperating. Something that is a so-called waste product, whey, on one farm, turns into extremely high-quality feed for another farm.
Yeah. So back to the process. After it settles.
Cut the curds. Drain the whey.
Drain the whey. And then the solid portion settles to the bottom of the vat, and it turns – and then all those chunks kind of get globbed together.
Right. This is the beginning process for many types of cheese.
Cheeses. So what I've described, the cultures would be different. The temperatures would be slightly different. The times would be slightly different. Your goal pHs would be slightly different for depending on the type of cheese you're making. But the whole process would be the same for almost every cheese.
Okay. So then what makes them different after this?
Well, so if I am going to make cheese curds, I take a long knife and I cut chunks out of that solid in the bottom, and then I take it, put it on my cutting board, take my big knife, and I cut it into the cheese curd shapes.
Oh, so these are all hand cut?
They're hand cut.
Oh, my. Is that the point where you add the flavorings in then?
Yeah, so then I'm essentially, I have a big, big bowl, and I add some salt, and I add, whatever other herbs I want to add, and I just mix it in by hand. And I've had requests for doing things like jalapeno and that sort of thing, but that would have to be added beforehand in order for it to be in the body of the cheese.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so I would have to do a whole batch.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole batch, I mean, we're talking like 70 pounds of cheese.
Especially if jalapenos might be a hard sell in the middle of Iowa.
Well, I'm sure I could sell, 20 packages of it in a week, but not 100.
But you do have good – tell us the flavors you do have.
Well, we have what has been the favorite is dill garlic. So we essentially add garlic powder and dill, and we get all of our herbs from Pioneer Co-op right now. I'm looking for local sources where I can get stuff from Iowa people, or at least some of them. Mm-hmm. Then we have what we call French, but it's Herbes de Provence. So it's an herb mix that has several different herbs, and then an Italian herb mix. Chipotle, so it has chipotle powder.
Oh, so you do have a spicy one.
And it's a little bit spicy. You can feel free to open it up if you want to try them. I put a little bit of ground or cracked black pepper in there, too, for a little bit of textural and visual contrast.
Well, I want to say to your person requesting jalapeno, I would think that these curds could be treated kind of the way fetas are and marinated in olive oil and further herbs, So if you wanted to take, for example, your chipotle or even one of your more plain ones, chop up some jalapenos, and, of course, I would add a little onion or garlic and some olive oil and let the curds rest in that for a while. You would end up with some pretty tasty stuff.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So.
It does sound good.
Everybody can customize it the way they want because you're starting with, I'm having the chipotle one. It's really
starting
good.
You're starting with a really good
product. There you go. So. Yummy.
So that's, the cheese curds, and that would be, I'm following a mozzarella recipe, so it's mozzarella cultures and so forth, which are a thermophilic, so that means that they thrive in a higher temperature than the mesophilic, which is a lower temperature culture, which is cheddar and jack and a lot of other cheeses are mesophilic. Cheddar curds, which are more common, would be following a cheddar recipe. Mm-hmm. And for cheddar, making curds is actually a part of the cheddar making process.
I thought
they
that
make
would be
curds.
Yummy.
so they make, they have to mill the curd whether they're making curds or not. And so with cheddar, it's not really anything extra. They just stop it at that stage. Whereas I'm doing an extra thing, for mozzarella, you wouldn't normally mill the curds. Because for cheddar, then you mill it and then you essentially mash it back together in what's called the cheddaring process.
Talk about some of these other lovely cheeses we have sitting here in our kitchen table.
Yeah, so first I want to talk about this one. I mean, it doesn't really have a name, and I don't know what cheese type what category it falls into, because it was kind of a happy accident.
That means you can make it up.
It was one night, it was maybe midnight, and I had maybe 30 pounds left in the vat, and I was like, I don't even know what I'm going to do with it, and I am tired, and I need to go to bed. And I said, all right, I'm going to take these last chunks, and I'm just going to put them in the brine bath and then just age them.
A brine bath is?
It is a big tank filled with salty water. So it's water with as much salt as you can fit in there. And I have a little bit of calcium chloride and a little bit of vinegar,
which definitely
helps
saltier.
To balance it. So this is essentially the same as the cheese curds. It's not pressed at all, but it's aged for about a month.
Oh.
Brined and aged about a month, mm-hmm. just as a block. Natural rind. I cut off the rind for this. Mm-hmm. We just called it limited edition. We sold it for 1 week at the farmer's market and made it available on Farm to Folk. But other than that, it's not a regular cheese we sell.
You could grate this probably pretty well.
Probably could.
Because of the saltiness, it'd be a good cooking cheese.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. That's good. You talked about a aging room. All the cheeses kind of go in there and commune with one another.
So the curds are considered a fresh cheese, like a mozzarella.
Yeah, so the curds, mm-hmm. after I cut them up and add the flavorings, I put them in a bag, I vacuum seal them, put them
they're
in the
ready
fridge,
to go.
They're ready to go.
Okay, now talk about aging. Because you're going to get more into aging as your business develops, right?
Well, so right now, actually, I need to get more shelves because I'm starting to get close to filling up my aging space
It
is now. So I've been making a lot of Ingrid's Pride, which is our signature provolone cheese.
So this is the Ingrid's
Pride.
So
that's what this big wedge here is.
Okay.
And so that is a similar make process, but I also add I cook the curd after I cut the curd. I bring up the temperature and so forth to drive more moisture out of it because I want a drier curd because it's going to be aged longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then both mozzarella and provolone are then stretched instead of taking the curds and cutting them up.
Oh, provolone is stretched like
a
mozzarella.
Stretched. They're both pasta filata cheeses. Mm. So you take it in 180 degree Fahrenheit water. And you stretch it.
You just pull it.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, well, so you do actually cut it
Are
up
you
and
pulling
cube
it with
it
your hands?
Yeah, so I have these insulated rubber gloves that I use because 180 degrees is
really
hot.
Warm.
And it takes a lot of your. I'm adding it. I do it in big bowls, and I have two different hot plates, and I'm heating water and adding it
and
turning it back
Kevin
and forth.
Kevin has strong, good young arms there.
I do a lot of physical work too, So that takes, so I'll do two batches at once.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's kind of like you stretch it a little bit and then add more hot water and let it sit for the heat to penetrate in there. And then I stretch it some more. And when it's like a silky smooth look to it all and it stretches out, I do like 6 pounds of curd at once and a big ball. And when I can stretch it out to like 3 feet, as far as I can reach and it looks nice and silky smooth, then it's ready to shape. And so I'll usually, I've been experimenting with shapes, but usually I do that 6 pounds into one nice ball.
Right. This looks like it was a piece of a ball, right?
Yes, it was a ball. So it was 6 pounds of curd, so it's probably five and a half pounds is the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take that and I put it in the brine bath. And it sits in the brine for 8 to 9 hours. And I flip it once in between. And
so do you control the saltiness by how long it's in the brine, basically?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can also add water to your – or add salt to your stretch water, which is what I do for a fresh mozzarella because I don't brine it.
Mm-hmm.
To make it a little bit salty, I add some water. So as it's stretching, it's taking in salt.
Okay. So after it sits in the brine, is that when it's ready to age?
That's when it's ready to age.
And how long has this one been aged, and how does it make its crust? I'm going to eat a piece that's like right near the skin.
This one was – the made-on date was 9/25.
Ah.
It's a little over a month, 6 weeks.
Here, Lana, taste the sort of near the skin. I find that it's always a little richer. So you must have trimmed
it. But also salt. Yeah.
So what's it look like on the outside of it?
So when you do natural rind cheeses, they get sort of mold growth on them. Mm-hmm. And you are, and I'm washing
the
outside.
Is it white, gray, what?
It's a blue-gray type of color. And I guess at this point we're kind of trimming the rinds because we're unsure of whether people are ready for seeing that or not.
Do you have to wash this or turn this?
We hang it in nets. So we use essentially like onion nets.
Uh-huh.
And then I hang them with a stainless steel S-hook. I hang them from my shelves. So out of one batch, I'll get about 12 balls that'll be hanging in nets. Mm-hmm. And then, so they hang there, and the aging room is 54 degrees, and I try and maintain it at 85% relative humidity.
Mm-hmm. Very precise. Okay. So now you've got your curds, you've got your
provolone?
Provolone part. What else?
Fresh mozzarella.
I know that Kevin is a very good washed rind cheesemaker. I'm waiting.
Oh, this is
I'm waiting. I'm
the soft
waiting.
Rind, you mean? I have not actually made a washed
soft
rind.
Soft rind.
Because the washed
me.
Rind is technically the ones with the red on the red bacteria on the outside.
Well,
like
whatever you've made for me a couple times.
The stinky cheeses, yeah, the ones that smell like smelly feet.
Well,
those are washed rind.
Well, okay, but what you're making then is called a soft rind. Is it more like a camembert family?
The camembert brie family.
Rind. I have to say, I think it takes a special skill set to make these cheeses well. And no one in Iowa is doing it. So I'm hoping you're going to move into that.
Ooh, that sounds something good.
I really hope to. And so that has – the complication with that is it has a two-step aging process. So I either need to have a separate aging room or a dedicated fridge for the second part of the aging process.
It's because you need a different temperature?
Need a different temperature.
What's the second temperature?
42.
Oh, even colder.
Yeah.
And how long do they take to make, like the ones that you've made that I've – tasted?
6 to 8 weeks.
Oh, that's not terrible. So then it's mostly terrible. An aging space issue.
Yes, it is. This is a little biological, not biological.
Scientific?
A little information about me. I spent 3 years in Germany working on dairy farms, and some of those farms were making cheese, and one farm was making camembert, and they did not have a dedicated space for it, for that.
And how did
it would be ready in maybe 2 weeks or something like that, but it won't be that creamy center.
Mm-hmm.
In order for that aging process to break down the proteins in the center to have that creaminess that you get in the center, has to be that cooler temperature. And if it's warmer,
for a longer period
of time. And if it's warmer and you leave it past maybe 2 weeks, then it'll start to like be really, really stinky.
Yeah. Well, I do have a theory. Because for most of my adult life anyway, the really good cheeses of soft rinds were imported. We now have a very strong, flourishing American cheese industry, and we are quite capable of having excellent domestic production. However, in the years when most of the cheeses were imported, by the time they get here, even if they're flying and this and that, they come in a little bit older than one would normally buy them in Europe. And so I think Americans didn't like them as much when I was in Europe, and I tasted them at their more appropriate sell-by date, of course I fell in love with them. And now that we're getting these cheeses in America, there are some coming certainly from California, probably some from the East Coast in New England, and probably some from Wisconsin and Minnesota. Of course we want them here in Iowa, Kevin.
Of course.
Yes,
of course.
We do.
Of course.
You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll listen to a little Iowa homegrown tune here from banjo player Bob Black. This is called the Nottoway Valley Breakdown. is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Kevin Dietzel, and we have found out that cheese making is a labor of love. There's lots of hands-on and being there and timing. It's a wonderful process.
And Kevin has Lost Lake Farm, which is, what town is it near?
Jewel,
yeah. So it's really our best local cheesemaker at the moment. Hallelujah. And he has his own cow, so it's a closed herd. And he is already available and selling at both Hy-Vees, right?
Both Hy-Vees and Ames.
And then soon to be in the Wheat's Field when they reopen their big cheese bar. And he has curds
and provolone are the products,
the products
that we have
of the moment
right now. And I do want to add, if you are ever tasting beers at Alluvial Brewing north of Ames, they have our cheese curds available.
Oh, yippee. I totally agree.
That's very good. And like you said, this is a labor of love. And you mentioned that each cheese takes certain care, takes certain temperatures, takes certain ages. So adding a new cheese is a big deal.
Yeah, because, of course, I'm urging him on to make soft rind cheeses because I know he's very talented.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was, you know, I've been making cheese for 7 or 8 years now on a home scale. And there, you know, the challenges are different because it's like, oh, I'll just, you know, like, do it on a small scale and figure out, you know, dedicate a portion of my fridge and take a box and create a microenvironment or whatever. Whereas here,
temperature and humidity wise,
temperature and humidity wise for aging, or you know, or you just, you know, you can manipulate things in the vat in a different way when you're doing 3 gallons of milk that you can't when you're dealing with 80 gallons, 100 gallons, which is really small on the factory scale of, you know, industrial commercial cheese making. But yeah, so it takes to add a new cheese. It takes planning, thinking about every step of the process, thinking about what equipment can I get that the inspector would approve. We also want to do an Alpine style, but it
and those are aged, kind of hard-ish cheese. It's more like,
yes,
yeah, as and, opposed to soft cheeses.
Yeah, and then Swiss cheese, the Emmentaler type with the holes, is a different kind of Alpine cheese. What I'm hung up on right now is it takes a lot of pressure. You have to press those cheeses.
Oh, so you need another piece of equipment.
A 10-pound wheel would take 100 to 200 pounds of pressure for each of those wheels.
So I would have to have eight of those presses. Oh.
Yeah, and so, you know, there are a lot of, you know, traditionally they would have used like a wooden lever with weights on it, but you can't do anything with wood and have the inspector approve it. Everything has to be stainless steel and all these things, washable, sanitizable. So thinking about the technology that I can do it on a do it every time, you know, regularly,
every
week.
On the scale that you have in the space that you have.
Well, this is a man who loves cheese. And so thanks to Kevin Dietzel from Lost Lake Farm for joining us today. And, yes, it's true. Blessed are the cheesemakers.
Website, Kevin. Website.
What's website.
LostLakeFarmLLC.com.
Okay.
So this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I'm Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas, and we've had Kevin Dietzel from Lost Lake Farm.
Engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.